Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index with me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily news service at theconstructionindex.co.uk. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things?
You well? Everything's fine at my end. I'm very well and keen to get to work with this week's episode because work, in fact, as you know better than I, is the theme of our discussion today, or rather more specifically, employment is the theme of our discussion. There have been a couple of very interesting stories breaking this week, which you've been working on. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, employment and remuneration, really. The first thing I wanted just to flag up was this pay freeze, the Construction Industry Joint Council agreement, which is negotiated between trade associations and the construction unions. It applies to something like 500,000 construction workers, primarily on the civil engineering side. And they were supposed to have, as per last year's negotiation, there was supposed to be a pay increase. I don't know what the percentage was, but some sort of small percentage pay increase was due in June this year. But with all that's going on, the employer's side thought, well, we need to postpone that, I'm afraid. And it's now just been revealed that they've imposed a freeze. There's going to be no increase for these 500,000 or so construction workers this year.
And is there a time scale, or is that for the foreseeable future? Is it open-ended?
It appears to be open-ended until we know what's going on. And I've got mixed feelings. On one hand, the union, Unite Union, says it the employer's doing this unilaterally, and they've got this collective bargaining agreement. And if one side can just say, no, we've changed our minds, it does call into question, as the Unite Union says, the credibility of the agreement process and the whole point of it. On the other hand, and I'm going to have three hands here. So on my second hand, construction workers won't, I don't think, get too much sympathy from the country as a whole, because unlike many other people in the leisure sector, entertainment, retail particularly, there are an awful lot of workers who are losing their jobs left, right and centre and earning nothing.
Yeah.
Now, while some construction workers are losing their jobs, there's still plenty of vacancies around. And on the whole, compared to other sectors of the economy, as we know, the construction industry hasn't been that badly hit.
No.
I don't want to make light of the problems that we're facing in the construction industry, but it could be worse. Now, I'm sure there's more sympathy for them than there is for Premier League footballers or Hollywood film stars who happen to be British or whatever. But yeah, I think, construction workers are, generally speaking, doing better than many, if not most, other industrial sectors.
But that works both ways, doesn't it, Phil? Because, as you said, the construction sector hasn't been as badly hit as other sectors. And, in fact, the employers, the contractors, generally speaking, seem to be fairly resilient. And so it makes you wonder, what justification do they have to impose this pay freeze if, basically they're muddling through pretty well?
Well, I was going to apply my third hand argument to this
back in favour
of a pay rise.
I forgot that you had three hands, Phil.
Which is the sterling work that the construction workers have been doing throughout the pandemic. I mean, a lot of the house building sites shut for a month or so, but a lot of the building sites, non-house building and civil engineering sites in particular, worked broadly speaking, worked through, and they've adapted to new working conditions. They're working, you know, different hours, and on the whole, the, you know, Johnny construction worker or Jenny construction worker has superbly stepped up to the plate. Particularly, I mean, you did a huge piece earlier in the year in the magazine about all the Nightingale hospitals and the other field hospitals in other parts of the United Kingdom. The you know, construction industry has played a blinder, and not a single gong, OBE, MBE, BEM for construction workers involved in the COVID response this year, which is, I thought, a bit of a shame. But how do you reward one without rewarding them all? So a pay increase would have been a nice nod to the troops to say thank you, and we recognise what you're doing. But yeah, you asked, if construction industry is not doing that bad, surely they can afford to pay a pay rise.
I think the fact that it was also a unilateral decision has got people's backs up. As you said, it's supposed to be a negotiated settlement, isn't it? This sort of wage agreement, it's you negotiate it. You don't just say, well, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, and if you don't like it, you can do the other thing.
But as we talked about before, with this wretched pandemic, all bets are off, and we will accept all sorts of totalitarian, authoritarian rules coming down on high and go, oh, yes, sir, we'll stay indoors. And gladly so, on the whole, so far. So, I don't know, the next step in all of this is Unite, the construction union, is now consulting with its local construction officers around the country to see where they workers might like to take local action to secure a pay increase. So they're saber rattling.
They are definitely
in the offing. Which would
The cynic in me made me think that because we've got this ongoing uncertainty about coronavirus, and nobody really knows what's going on at all. We're all very uncertain, and I think a little bit rattled by the whole thing. So I think under the current circumstances, a lot of workers will feel vulnerable and feel that their job isn't secure, and perhaps they'd just be quite easy to bully into accepting a pay freeze. And when under previous circumstances, they would have resisted that. I mean, obviously the union on their behalf is doing that, but I wonder if the employers thought, well, you know, let's just hedge our bets, you know, put money in the bank and delay the pay freeze. And they'll accept it because...
Delay the pay rise, you mean?
So, pay rise, yes, exactly. And that people would accept that because they'd feel lucky to have a job at all. I don't know if that's a good...
I don't know, but that doesn't seem like a wild supposition to me.
No.
But not everyone. Not everyone's being a bad guy. If we talk about pay freezes as being bad guy people, we also reported this week that Morgan Sindall Construction has agreed to pay the living wage, which is something more than the minimum wage. Not much more. It's depending where you are outside of London. It's 58 pence an hour more than the minimum wage. The current minimum wage for over 25s is £8.72, according to what I've read. Apologies if I'm out of date on that number. And the living wage, which is a purely voluntary thing, there's something called the Living Wage Foundation, I think, and any employer who wants to show themselves as a good guy. And there are 6,600 employers across the UK or so who are voluntarily committed to paying the living wage, at least the living wage, at least £9.30 an hour or £10.75 in London. So you think, oh, well done, Morgan Sindall Construction, for going above and beyond what their legal commitment is. But it's not much, is it? I mean, I can't imagine many Morgan Sindall employees are on or were on £8.72 and now on £9.30. I can't even get my ironing done for that.
I think the difference, the key difference between a minimum wage and the living wage is that the living wage is really the only metric which is actually calculated according to the cost of living where you are. I mean, you could be on the minimum wage and still having to go to a food bank every week in order to feed your family. The idea of a living wage is that you can live on your wage, which is, I know it's fairly obvious, but a lot of people really struggle. So it's a good thing. I had a look at the Living Wage Foundation website, and apparently, I don't know how current these figures are, they say that there are now 125 living wage employers in the construction industry. Couldn't actually find out the names of many of the others.
I know Land Security is one. A couple of 5 years ago now, reported that what was then, I think, the UKAT union, which has merged with Unite, they staging protests outside Land Security. Land Security is the biggest, but a big
developer.
In London, yeah. Lots of the big London sites. Yeah. And they were trying to get them to pay at least the London living wage, because in London, minimum wage is particularly hard to live on, I think, because it's so expensive to live in London. And it's about a year later or so, spring 2016, Land Security said, anyone on our sites, we will ensure that they get the London living wage. Battersea Power Station Development as well, I know, has got that. But I don't know any of the which contractors are signed up to it. And you're saying you had a look?
There is a list, but it's a very long list, and I didn't have time to go through it this morning. There are apparently over 120 employers in the construction industry. I don't know how broadly they define the construction industry. I mean, I wouldn't have considered Land Security to be a construction employer, although, of course, if they're imposing that on their contractors who are working on their sites, then they are de facto construction firm. But they say that the number of construction firms joining is accelerating, and the current number is growing by 76% over the past year, they said. So it's pretty good. And I think, although, yes, I agree with you, the living wage is still not exactly bountiful. I think it is a step in the right direction. I think we should applaud employers like Morgan Sindall for signing up to this and becoming accredited. And Morgan Sindall does have a reputation as a good employer. I mean, they're a solid company. They're doing, they seem to be performing well. They're number four in our top 100, I noticed, this year. We discussed this recently, didn't we, only a couple of weeks ago. They and Wilmot Dixon are now, according to Glassdoor, the two best employers. Yes. Yeah, the best places to work in construction.
We're saying we believe there's a correlation between the name above the door and the person at the top of the company. That although Morgan Sindall is stock market listed, it's still got John Morgan in charge, and Wilmot Dixon has got Rick Wilmot in charge, and this sort of thing.
Yes, precisely. So I think companies that do this kind of thing, it might be box ticking, but I don't think you can really criticise them for it. And I think that they are setting the example. So and in fact, Morgan Sindall said in their statement, you know, we encourage other people in the industry to do, you know, to follow our example, which I think people should, quite frankly. Well, I think, Phil, this is probably a good point at which to introduce this week's special guest. We have another guest, which is really nice. It's nice to be joined by people from the industry. Our guest this week is Paul Clarkson, and Paul is Managing Director of building contractor Triton Construction, which was set up in 2005 and is headquartered in Liversedge in West Yorkshire, with a northwest regional office in Warrington. Triton is a general contractor carrying out construction work across a wide range of sectors, including healthcare, education, leisure, commercial, retail, and so on, throughout the north of England. But the company's in the news this week because it has become the latest construction firm to transfer ownership of the business to its employees via an employee ownership trust, or EOT for short. So welcome to Reconstruction, Paul. It's good to have you here.
Good morning.
I hope that introduction wasn't too wordy. I'm sure I haven't said it all. There's plenty more to be said. So Triton Construction, quite a young firm, 2005. So you haven't been going for very long. Tell us a little bit about the background of the firm and your rationale behind this decision.
Okay, the firm was set up by Mike Parkinson in 2005, who had worked in the industry like I have for well over 30 years. I'd worked with Mike perhaps 15 years ago when we were both at Totties, another business that you might remember.
Part of ISG I think, isn't it?
It was wrapped up into ISG eventually. I mean, it went through various iterations, but it ended up with ISG, yes. Mike left the business when ISG became, just before actually, they became the owners and set up Triton. in 2005. I've only been with the business now just under 2 years. So I joined the business to allow Mike to take a step back after 15 years in the business. And he's done that as part of a... We've had a stage two two-stage process going on. We've Mike set up an EMI, earned management investment shares with the existing directors, which I partook in as well when I joined the business. Mm-hmm. And that divested 50% of the business to the existing directors. And this is in effect part two of Mike exiting the business, although he will, under the EOT, stay involved as chairman of the trust.
Right. So this has been a long time in the planning then, has it? It wasn't something which you decided in the past few months might be a good idea. It's something you've been working towards.
Well, Mike certainly has. Mike had worked at a high level in the industry for many years. And when he set up Triton back in 2005, I think he had, well, he definitely had a vision of where he wanted to be in 15 years' time. Mm. And that wasn't working at the business into his 60s, trying to find an exit. It was planning an exit from day one, in effect. Right. So part one of the exit was a partial MBO, or EMIs rather, and part two of the exit was what's been done now. Although the EOT didn't really come onto the scene until late last year, really.
So how does it actually work there? It always sounds like that this, you know, benevolent, lovely man has given all his business away to the employees. But presumably he still gets to buy a speedboat somehow, doesn't he? He gets some money out of it, doesn't he? And how does that work?
Yeah. Clearly, it's not completely altruistic. Things never are they? How it works was, I mean, if I just go back a step, so we had the choice of either a trade sale or a standard management buyout. Hmm. Now, a trade sale means the business changes, the staff get disturbed, nothing stays the same. A management buyout means you keep the same management team, but the management team have to borrow a load of money, put the company into debt to pay out the existing shareholders, and that all causes problems. So we came across the trust, the EOT, Employee Ownership Trust, probably by accident, maybe 18 months ago, started looking into it and really got involved in it probably just after Christmas. So it's only taken about 9 months to do this, which is incredibly quick in comparison to an MBO. Yeah. Yes, what it means is that the business is sold to the employees, and the employees, there's two ways of doing it. The business could have borrowed money and paid out the existing shareholders at day one, and left the employees as the trust with a big debt, or what we decided to do was do it over time. So as we accrue profits, the existing shareholders are paid out of those profits over a number of years.
So essentially, Mike Parkinson, the former owner, is drawing dividends for the next so many years to get his money back that way.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. In effect, yes. And he's not the only shareholder, because there was two original shareholders when Triton was set up, which were investment shareholders, non-executives. So those two, and Mike, and one of the retiring directors who had shares, they all wanted to exit, which was driving this, which round about 50% of the shareholding. So they get an exit over time now, paid out of profits. And what we've done is we've said that the business must always maintain a net value, that if it's if the profits aren't there to allow them to be paid out, they aren't paid out. Hmm. So the asset value of the business is set at a level, and we can't pay out dividends, if you want to call them dividends, or loan notes, as they are actually described. We can't pay them out unless we maintain the asset base.
So how do you actually transfer ownership to your employees? I mean, do you give them certificates saying you own 0.00% of the company? Do you give them share certificates? So how does it work? And how do you distribute the value of the firm amongst the workforce?
Do you all have the same equal shareholding, or as the boss, do you own a bit much bigger chunk than the person who answers the phones?
There's a couple of things, a few questions there. I mean, you'll be aware, because you'll probably done a bit of research, that EOT was set up by the coalition government. Mm. They did some research that said EOTs were the best performing type of business, and therefore they set up a system under statute that allowed for the EOTs, and it is very restricted in what you can and can't do. So you've got to work within the straitjacket of the statute that was set up. In effect, in terms of shareholding, you set up a trust, and that trust holds the shares on behalf of the staff. So the staff don't get any share certificates. The shares are held in trust on behalf of the staff. The trust is a limited company that's set up as a trust, and that comes under the regulations for trusts, because there are various government regulations appertaining to trusts as well as the EOT. And the trust has trustees, and those trustees are drawn. Mike Parkinson is going to stay initially as the chair of the trustees, and there's three trustees, two of which are employees. So we've there's a couple of our employees that have stepped up and put their hands up to be trustees, so that Mike isn't in total control. He's in effect outvoted by the two employees in the trust, and the trust holds those shares on behalf of the staff. The staff then have a mechanism called a staff committee, which the trust reports into. And the staff committee have a number of powers. Day to day, they don't really have any powers. They can make recommendations, try and advise the board on what might be good ideas on site or within the office, or what might be beneficial as from a health perspective, from a mental health perspective, and things like that. They can make loads of recommendations. Those recommendations are taken on. Are taken to the trustees, and the trustees pass those recommendations back to the board, and the board don't have to act on these. Day to day, the board runs the business as it always ran it, and the committee has some quite strong powers. Really, the staff committee can vote off the trust. So the three members that have been set up for the trust at the moment, the chairman included, could be voted off next week when they have a meeting. So they could vote off the trustees and ask for and appoint new trustees. That's one of the probably major powers they've got. They can hold the directors to account, but only if the directors are doing things that are fraudulent or things like that. They can't say, look, I don't agree with your decision, you can't do it. You know, the directors have power over all the decisions of the business.
Phil.
So I was just going to ask, sorry, David. Who decides whether you get to keep your job or not?
Yeah.
me, I guess.
So you're still in charge, even though the employees own you?
Yes. I mean, it's pretty much like the John Lewis model. You've got thousands of employees there, and if you can just imagine running a business with thousands of different opinions funneling into an employee committee, and it'd be very difficult. It'd be right managing rats in a sack, wouldn't it? Yeah. You've got to have some clear direction to the business. The committee have a number of powers, but they are limited. The benefits to the employees is that they have a vested interest in the performance of the business. Yeah. I guess is where the employees get the benefits, insofar as they're entitled to bonus payments that are tax free, up to a level of $3,600 a year. So that's part of the mechanism of the trust. There are incentives for the selling shareholders from a taxation point of view. Which is why I think EOTs are becoming quite popular now, because of the disincentive in terms of entrepreneurial relief, which has reduced from 10 million to 1 million, as you'll know, in the last budget. So I think a lot more businesses are looking at how can I exit this business now that I haven't got entrepreneurial tax relief at 10%, how can I exit the business without paying 40%? And the EOT is a way of doing that. There's some tax benefits for the exiting shareholders. And in return for those tax benefits, you're handing the business over to the employees. The employees, out of profits every year, at the moment we're setting aside 5% of, out of the profitability to pay back to the employees as a bonus. And that will continue until, in effect, the existing shareholders are paid out.
If trading conditions were like they were a couple of years ago, you'd be looking at 6 to 8 years to pay off the former owners. What percentage of profit are you committing to the former owners? You say you're setting aside 5% for employees' bonuses.
Well, as long as we maintain the asset value of the business that we've established as a minimum asset value, then the rest can be returned to the shareholders. So you could theoretically return 95% to the former shareholders. Yes. Mm. Because what you do, the former shareholders' loan notes are created, so the EOT owe money to the former shareholders, and until those loan notes are paid off, the employees, as the now shareholders, can't increase their bonus payments above the 5% that it's capped at. Mm. Now, when they've paid off the existing shareholders, let's say 7 years, paid off the existing shareholders, we've put into the articles of the trust, and to be fair, the committee can change these, but at the moment we've put in that they can take 50% of the profit after that point as bonuses in effect, and return those back to the employees. So if you made £2 million, £1 million could be redistributed to the employees on a yearly basis, of which they would get 3,600 tax-free, and the rest would be taxed at whatever the going rates were. For a capital gains or whatever it's classed at, because taxation changes all the time, doesn't it?
Is that 3,600 figure pegged by government regulation?
That's in the government regulations for the EOT Trust, yeah. They can an individual employee shareholder can only have 3,600 tax-free. After that, they can have more money but in terms of bonus, clearly, but they don't get it tax-free. It's at whatever the current tax rate appertaining to their situation is.
So what happens when a member of staff resigns and goes and works for somebody else or just retires? Do they relinquish their shareholding?
They relinquish the shareholding and that's it. Gone. Nothing.
Do they get a payout? I mean, do they say, I want my dividends?
No, because the shares are held in trust, you see, yes. and it's only for the benefit of the employees, not past, previous or whatever, it's present employees.
So there's another incentive to stay with the company.
It's an incentive to keep good employees with the company, especially, you imagine, after 7 years, let's say 7 years, the business has been paid off and the employees are taking £1 million a year in bonuses, and there's 100 employees, you know, the bonuses are substantial, and it's a good way to incentivize people into the business as well for us.
It certainly seems to be something that is sort of gaining traction in the construction industry, because you've run quite a few stories about companies doing this, haven't you, Phil?
Well, I don't have done that many yet, but McGee Construction earlier this year transferred, the McGee family transferred their business to an employee ownership trust as well. And I was going to ask Paul, I guess that you might have had some correspondence or phone calls from people around the industry going, oh, this sounds interesting. What have you done? Why have you done this? Have you got any, is there a grapevine of other companies following the lead of you and McGee on this?
I haven't at the moment, but then it's only become public knowledge in the last sort of week and a half, yeah. Since the deal was completed at the end of September. I possibly, next time I'm at, my trouble is we're not meeting as many people these days either, are we, used to do, but I'm sure next time I manage to get to a meeting where you can speak to people, I'm sure people will be saying, hey, what's going on? Why have you done this? But at the moment, I haven't had a load of contacts with regards to that, no.
I had a look at the list of companies that are employee-owned one way or another. You mentioned John Lewis. I mean, that's very familiar and well-known. Richer Sounds, the hi-fi retailer. But most of the employee-owned companies seem to be some sort of professional services companies, whether they're law firms or in construction, we've got Arup and Mott MacDonald, for example, are employee-owned. And you can sort of see that it seems to lend itself to something where there might be a flatter hierarchy where everyone is sort of, you know, doctor, professor, white collar person. Whereas in a contractor like yours, where it's perhaps more of a pyramid or a triangle structure, you use the phrase that, you know, if everyone had equal say, it would be, you know, managing rats in a bag or whatever, cats in a bag or whatever it was. Have you encountered any challenges? Do you anticipate any challenges from a contracting organisation that maybe a professional services organisation wouldn't face?
It's a good point. I mean, it's early days for us. I guess it depends on the structure of your contracting company, really. I mean, we are predominantly a management contractor, so we have very few direct labour resources. We subcontract the works, we manage it, so we are almost a professional services company anyway, insofar as the way we manage the projects, which is, I suppose, the norm for many contractors now, although there are contractors out there that still hold large workforces and plant and materials and do it rather than through the subcontractors, do it direct. I don't see why it can't work in both situations. I mean, in terms of ourselves, from the operatives, we do have some operatives, from the operatives right up to the senior managers, they all take part in the bonus system. The way the bonus system's structured is that it's based on salary. So so the bonuses are paid proportionate to salary and to length of service. There's a calculation that goes into that to decide what the bonus is.
How many employees do you have, by the way, Paul?
At the moment, about 56. 56 right. Employees, yeah, directly employed.
Is the bonus a way of not giving a pay rise? I used to work for companies that would give me a new job title every year instead of a pay rise.
I'm certainly not looking at it that way. We will pay as we've always done, competitive amounts of money in the market. Mm-hmm. As you have rightly pointed out, it can be a benefit to us in terms of encouraging people to the business because it gives them a vested interest and based on performance, the company can pay them an increased remuneration through the bonus. But it's certainly not, I've certainly not seen it as an opportunity to perhaps hold wages flat, because certainly for the next 7 years, it's not going to be, or until we've paid off the existing shareholding, it's not going to be, a golden pot for anybody, really. No. It could be. And that's the incentive to everybody to strive together in the same direction, isn't it?
I assume that the workforce has been pretty enthusiastic about this. If you tell them, how do you like to own the company? I suppose most people would say, that's quite a nice idea. Thanks very much. Were there any doubting Thomases there? Anybody, any sort of voices of dissent?
Not really. We held a number of discussions with the staff towards the end of September. Socially distanced discussions spread over six sessions because of COVID, etc. Yes, it was all very well received by everybody. I haven't had personally any negative reactions. We've had lots of questions. How does it work? Yes. How does my bonus get calculated? Etc. And we've been very open. We've given them spreadsheets that show exactly how, based on their salary and their length of service, the points they accrue and how that converts into bonus and things like that. So they can calculate it themselves. We are owned by the employees now. So yes. I'm expecting to work very much more like a PLC. I will be doing quarterly reports to the trustees, and the trustees will be sharing those with the committee. The committee can call me to explain why my business plan hasn't worked out as I said it would, or why it's going better. They can't instruct me to do anything, but they can call me to account and ask me to explain what's going on and why is COVID impacting us in such a way or not. So I expect to have quite a bit more sort of interaction with the committee.
It sounds like you've actually got more authority than you had before in terms of what you can do, because while the trust and the council can advise, consult, express opinion, but when I asked earlier who ultimately had the hiring and firing power over the top man, it sounded like there's no one, whereas before the shareholders could vote you out.
I mean, Yeah, I mean the trust could, you know, the trustees could say, you know, Paul, we think you're not performing. Yeah, like you would with them, but then we can't get rid of people now anyway for ageism, can we? So, you know, it's it's like any other employee, really. I'm an employee of the trust, and they would have to have good reasons to ask me to leave. And good reason, you know, there would be a process, as you would with an underperforming employee. So you would get them in, you would...
The trust acts in exactly the same way that shareholders would do in a PLC then?
Yes, very much so. It's very much like the shareholders of a PLC reporting back to the PLC board, expressing doubts that the business is going in the right direction or other, and having a dialogue. And you know, obviously, if confidence, very much like PLCs, if confidence would be lost in me completely, then you know, I would have to go, wouldn't I? Mm. I guess, but you know, it's got to be through a process of, well, you said this was going to happen, you said that was going to happen, this hasn't happened. You know, there's a process to go through, isn't there?
It does sound like what you might call a win-win. It seems to have it seems to tick many, many boxes. I can't help wondering what the catch is.
Yeah, well, that's I guess that's what I kept asking myself when it was put to me as well. I mean, one of the things we have done, just to be absolutely clear to you, that the directors in the business, although the trust has taken 100% of the business, the directors of the business have been granted just over 20% of new EMIs in the business, and up to a maximum in the trust statute, you can have up to 25% of the business owned by another party. So the existing directors have all got 3-year qualifying EMIs now, up to a maximum value of 25% of the business.
And EMI stands for, one more time?
Earned Management Incentive Shares. So they are to, because obviously, you know, what are we getting out of it? I suppose you haven't asked that question, but what do I get out of it, and what do the other directors get out of this EOT? Well, we get a shareholding in the business, which is not the same as the employees. We can't, under the statute, any director can't own more than 5% of the shareholding. Mm-hmm. So across the directors, we've got 25% set aside in EMIs that can be actionable after 3 years, i.e. taken on as shares, at which time you have to have the business valued and agreed with HMRC and pay the cost of the shares. Mm-hmm. Based at the valuation of the HMRC, which is it's a complicated process, but you get a reduced amount to pay as an EMI because you've worked towards getting those shares. So you're not paying the actual share value; you pay probably however the HMRC value at that time, maybe 1/20th of the share price. Mm-hmm. as it stands at the moment, or the value of the business. Very much like EMIs work under. The current regimes that are in place, like the Entrepreneurs Relief.
It sounds like a legacy of the coalition government that I actually approve of. Actually, there's a few things they did which I don't think was quite so successful as that.
Well, it was actually Vince Cable. I think they were, well, my opinion is they were looking for a job for Vince Cable because he was a heavyweight. They didn't really have a particular position for him, so they put him in charge of business and said, "Off you go, Vince. Come up with some ideas." He actually went out to industry and looked at industries for about 2 years to ascertain what the best performing model was, and came back with his advisors and said, "Look, I think EOT is the best performing model in the UK from statistical analysis. I want to incentivize this." And the coalition said, "Okay, Vince, it's your hobby horse. Get on with it." And off he went, and it went through Parliament, and it went into it was put into statute, and for years it's not really got much traction. It's not been well advertised. I think up to last year there was only about 200 businesses that had over maybe 5 or 6 years that had become EOTs. But since last year, I think that's running into the thousands now. Possibly. So it's certainly a model that's gaining traction. I mean, just to go back a little bit, what has to happen is that you have to get the business valued, and you have to agree that valuation with HMRC and get HMRC approval before you can move forward with the EOT. because HMRC are giving tax breaks and things to both the employees and the sellers. So it all has to get HMRC approval before you can actually do the deal.
Are you expecting that now you are joining the ranks of progressive enlightened companies who present themselves in such a way, like the John Lewis and Richer Sounds and Arabs and so on, that you think that will help you win business? Are you going to use this in your marketing at all, or is this just something behind the scenes that is how you operate your...
No, I think definitely. I mean, definitely one of our aspirations, you'll have seen in the press release, is to continue to grow the business. One of the areas that I've been heavily involved in the past in previous businesses is frameworks with the public sector. And I would have thought the model we've got is would align nicely with the public sector's aspirations.
Tick a box somewhere, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure it would.
If you're bidding for work and you say, you know, we are an employee-owned business and our the people you'll be dealing with are incentivized to make a success of whatever enterprise they're involved with, well, that probably counts for something as well. You've got people who are motivated.
Does,
you know. Yeah, yeah.
And Vince's own modelling said that those businesses perform better because of that buy-in from the staff.
Yeah,
you know. And
so,
long have Arabs and Mott's been employee-owned, Phil? Do you know? Does that go back a long, long way?
Who are you going to say? Sorry, David.
Ove Arup and Mott MacDonald. How long have they been employee-owned? Yes.
Yeah, they were not set up under the regime of this model that the government's put in place.
They predate the legislation, definitely.
They do, yes. So they probably have slightly different rules, and the way they've structured it is slightly different. I mean, if you do it now, you've got to work within the Act of Parliament and the statute around it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I should imagine that there will be quite a few following your lead on this, because it does sound like it has a lot to offer, particularly for a company of your size, I would have thought, especially if you've got aspirations for growth.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And, I think it's as you said, it's a marketing tool. It gets everybody on board going in a single direction to grow the business, because if we grow the business and we become more profitable, ultimately that pays off the existing shareholders quicker and then returns some profitability to the members of the trust.
When did the transaction actually take place?
The 30th of September.
So it's just been 3 weeks. Have you seen any change in the workforce in the past 3 weeks? Does the any new cars in the car park? People getting flash?
No new cars at the moment. It's occurred at a very difficult time, hasn't it? The timing, in a lot of ways, you'd think, well, Jesus, the timing couldn't be worse. But I've not seen any immediate difference in the workforce, but then our workforce was generally pretty happy and wanted to get on and do the best for everybody anyway. So we're not a big company, so we have got a flat management structure. Everybody knows me by name. I visit the sites, the people, my doors open and people come in and have a chat. It's not as the hierarchical structure you described earlier, because we are a smaller business. Whether this exact model would work in a much larger business with those hierarchical constraints, it does do in Arup and others, but then they predate the legislation, so I couldn't say really. I guess everybody's got to look at it from their own perspective really, and you've got to convince the HMRC that you're not doing it just to get the tax breaks and pay off the shareholders. That's part of the application that you put in with the third party valuation that the HMRC have to agree to.
Well, I'm not sure that the present circumstances are that bad for doing something like this. You said you couldn't have chosen a worse time, but Phil and I were talking just before we introduced you. We were talking about job security and the fact that some people are perhaps feeling that they lack job security. Certainly, the people who work for Triton probably feel a little bit more secure than they did 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Definitely, quite possibly, and they'll know that their efforts, will directly impact that as well.
Well, I hope the company goes from strength to strength, Paul, and Liversidge turns out like the town of Nokia in Finland in the mid-90s.
Yes, let's hope so. Yeah, yes, we'd all be very happy if that happened. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, fantastic. Well, look, thanks ever so much for joining us, Paul. It's really great talking to you, and a fascinating topic, which I'm sure we'll return to in due course. So thanks for joining us.
Okay, many thanks, gents.
Well, our thanks to Paul Clarkson, Managing Director of Triton Construction, for joining us this week. If you are thinking of handing or selling your company to your employees, we want to know about it, so email us, please, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. But we will be back again, David and myself, with another conversation, same time next week, or possibly even earlier. So thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk.